This is, of course, the Crime Time feature. And we're going to speak to Times Live journalists and Sunday Times, and as well as the Sunday Times at the Times Media Group. And that is, of course, Tanya Faber. But what Tanya has also managed to do is that she has, of course, written a book called Blood on Her Hands, South Africa's Most Notorious Female Killers. Now, Tanya, the last time I admitted to this, I got lynched on Twitter. Someone was like, how do you interview someone without having read the book? But, you know, if you have to take into account that, you know, I just recently found out that I'm in for Aubrey. I couldn't get my grubby little hands on your book, number one. Number two, if you take into consideration the number of books that we discuss on a show like this, it would be virtually impossible, you know, to read every single one of them. But your book sounds absolutely stunning and fascinating. Good evening to you.
Hi, good evening, and good evening to the viewers. And yeah, maybe after our discussion, you'll be inspired to read it, or you'll be too terrified to read it.
No, you know, it's weird. I'm going through a very weird phase. My wife and I were chatting now the other day, and we've noticed that our movie catalog, you know, is made up largely of horror. And it's either a testament that it's a really good genre or film, or alternatively, what it tells us is that we've become really macabre as the years went on.
I think we're all vicariously through the fear of the, you know, these stories, and, you know, it's kind of exciting because we can watch it and experience it, but it's not happening to us, you know, so it's almost voyeuristic in a way. But I think most people are very attracted to the genre, so, you know,
yeah,
it's exactly. Only human.
That's only human. And I take it that yours, although, you know, it's real life horror, I take it. It tells quite a macabre tale of these various people.
Well, yes, what I did was I focused not even primarily, I focused only on women.
Uh-huh.
And I only focused on women who one could say had agency over what they did. I did not include any women who, you know, in South Africa, we have so many women who are officially on their rap sheet in jail for murder. But in and amongst those women, you might have a very poor woman who gave birth to a child and abandoned the baby because she could not see her way fit to feed and look after the baby on her own, maybe living in a shack without electricity or water. Now, someone like that, I did not include in my book, because you look at a woman like that and you go, I feel, well, I can't say everybody, but I feel empathy for her. The women in my book are all women who should be held accountable for what they did. And, you know, if they're still alive, they are still being held accountable for what they did. So that was my kind of my threshold for who I was going to include and not include in the book about the women who've committed murder in the country.
So why the primary focus on women in this particular instance? Because, I mean, and I guess a lot of the time when we do talk about the subject matter, it's men are at the center of it. And I guess statistically, men are more prone to this type of behavior and doing these types of things. But why your primary focus, or not primary, your focus on women in this instance?
Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I'm a journalist and an author, and, you know, this thing that you've just described is a dilemma that we always have in journalism, actually. So, you know, you can look at one topic and you go, this is so ubiquitous and it happens so much that we should be talking about it, because statistically it is worrying and overwhelming. On the other hand, it almost becomes less newsworthy the more ubiquitous it is. So, you know, you kind of, your fascination or your gaze turns to the more unusual, even though, you know, we should also be talking about the things that happen more commonly. But most interestingly, I think, is the fact that my idea for the book actually was born while I was covering the trial of a male murderer. And if I can just take a moment to explain that to you, because it sounds like twisted that it would be a male murderer that would make me want to write about a woman. But I was covering the Henry van Bredaar trial in the High Court in Cape Town. And I was fascinated by how fascinated the public was with this particular murder. You know, murder is pretty common, sadly, in South Africa. And it spans, you know, the entire socioeconomic spectrum, that more murders occur in communities, obviously, where people are really lacking in resources. So here comes this blue-eyed, white Afrikaans boy. He's incredibly wealthy. He lives in the lap of luxury. His family has lived overseas. And one night, he goes crazy, and he takes an axe, and he wipes out his whole family, except for his sister, who he leaves with irreparable amnesia, so she can't remember what happened. And I suddenly realized that the public fascination with the story was all to do with how unusual it was, and the fact that he was wealthy and he was living this glamorous life. And it pains us to admit it, especially if we consider ourselves to be, you know, journalists with a social conscience and all that.
Yeah.
It pains us to admit that we are more interested in more unusual murders, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the fact that, you know, 95% of murderers are male, you can begin to understand why people find female murderers possibly more interesting. And if you think about it, every time there is a murder committed by a male, there's a lot less interest in what he looks like. But yet when there's a female murderer, people really want to see a photograph of that woman in the newspaper or on a digital news site. And it's just this, it's this anomaly of, you know, we don't expect it from a woman. And when it happens, we are drawn to it like moths to the flame. So that's why I chose women instead of men, even though they only make up, or because of the fact that they only make up 5% of murderers.
No, no, absolutely fascinating. I mean, I'm looking at the this case of, and the name just evades me now, you know, of this female police officer, you know, that dispatched of family members, allegedly dispatched of family members in return for, or, you know, in return for, you know, insurance money. And, you know, social media is awash with her images. And you know, I actually just saw a series of tweets where an actress has been recommended to play her, you know, if it ever goes to film.
That's crazy.
Exactly. And you know, I was thinking that, I mean, there's many men who have been responsible for equally horrendous acts. And you know, yeah, they may trend on the day that the story breaks. But then after that, we sort of forget. They get lost somewhere in the headlines. And then we start following any, you know, or everything else. If I think about Oscar Pistorius, I mean, that was probably the other instance where we saw such massive, massive interest in a criminal matter involving murder. But again, there was something very anomalous about that, you know, Paralympian, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you know what you're saying about people wanting to know what this the female cop looks like. I think that is a lot to do with our perception of what a murderer would look like. So, you know, when if I say to you that a man goes into a bar and he gets drunk and he impulsively gets involved in a fight, there's an image that will come into your mind that will fit very well with the kind of the semiotics of, you know, how you would imagine that man to look. And I'm not talking racially or socioeconomically here. I'm talking purely about a guy with a knife or a gun in a bar who is inebriated, right?
Yeah.
But if I say to you a female murderer, and then you consider that, you know, our kind of our stereotypes of what a woman is and why it's so weird when she commits murder, it's, you know, if you go from Victorian ages right up until now, you go, well, women were always seen as being more innately virtuous.
Women are
nurturers. So we want to know what this weird creature would look like if she is defying all the stereotypes and all the kind of, you know, the preconceived ideas of who we think she is. And we want to see now what does this exotic creature look like, you know, this person that has defied all these adjectives that I've just attached to, you know, a stereotypical female from Victorian era to now. And I think that's part of it. And also the fascination with a woman's clothing at a trial. I mean, how many column inches were given to Najwa Peterson's outfits in court, for example?
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to see that about a female, about a male murderer. There might be one journalist who adds a bit of color and describes his jacket, if his jacket was creased or something. But generally, you're not having people clamoring to find out what a male murderer was wearing in court, you know?
And I must say the brand name, I'm not going to say it, but it seems that South African criminals seem to have a uniform. It's always usually one brand that's involved. You know which one I'm talking about.
Absolutely, yes.
Always. And it's a weird thing because I've noticed myself, I think in the week, I was driving and I saw a guy wearing a similar top and I was like, mm-hmm.
It's so funny. Yeah, the kind of semiotics have shifted from, you know, wealth to, are you dodgy?
Exactly. But, you know, the Americans have Eileen Wuornos, of course, Charlize Theron, played it really well, you know, to the extent that she actually got an Oscar for that particular role. But South Africa, you know, that's not the only connection that South Africa has with us. And I actually mentioned it before I even knew that she features in your book, Daisy De Melker. I think there's, you know, everyone knows about Daisy De Melker, but please do remind us of who she is and what she did and why. You know, she comes to mind, like with me, where she was, I mentioned her without necessarily even looking at who are some of the people that you've covered.
I'm very glad you asked me that question, because of all the 9 women who I covered in my book, Daisy, even within this, you know, catalogue of anomalies, she is even more of an anomaly. And I'll tell you why. You know, as you say, there's a reason why 100 years later, we are all still talking about Daisy De Melker. And you can mention her name to virtually any adult South African and they will know her name. And the reason why is because a female serial killer who acts alone is incredibly unusual. You know, all the other women in my book either had accomplices or, you know, they hired hitmen, for example. But Daisy De Melker acted completely alone. And she is also the only serial killer. Now, let me just explain the difference between a serial killer and a spree killer. And maybe people already know this, but I will just say it anyway in case there are listeners who don't know. So a spree killer is somebody who goes on a killing spree, you know, and there might be a day or two or even a week between murders.
Uh-huh.
But the kind of the high or the fever of their excitement of having killed someone has not cooled off between the murders. So that's a spree killer.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So in the book, you've got Charmaine Phillips. She's an example of a spree killer. And of course, her accomplice was the much older Peter Grindling. But Daisy De Melker was a serial killer. There were weeks and years between the murders she committed. And she committed those nearest and dearest to her. And she also, you know, she poisoned people. And now the most interesting thing about her, and I think why we still talk about her, is because she poisoned them, and she was a nurse.
Oh.
So she was almost, you know, she was on paper, she was a nurturer who knew a lot about medication to help people. And instead she used both of those things to entrap her victims, you know, so her kind of, you know, you'll see if you read the book, her husband's who she killed. You know, she would literally cradle them in her arms and nurse them, but she was the one who had administered the arsenic.
Wow.
You know? So, and her knowledge of exactly how much arsenic or strychnine to give was also very measured because she had this medical knowledge. So, in fact, there was a study done by an American researcher called Marissa Harrison, and she looked at female serial killers. And she found overwhelmingly, and this is not just in South Africa where, you know, we are still so stratified according to race and class, but she found that the majority of female serial killers had a kind of, there were certain characteristics. So they were often in a caregiving role. So, you know, your nursery school teacher, your Sunday school teacher, your nurse, your doctor. Most of them were white. Most of them were educated. Most of them were middle class. And they all knew or were related to their victims. And they often went for the most vulnerable people in their own life. So the children or the elderly or the infirm.
Yeah.
Okay, so Daisy killed her husbands who weren't elderly or infirm. But, you know, she ticks all the other boxes perfectly. And I think that's why we're still talking about her, you know, because she was a serial killer, and it was 100 years ago, and she poisoned people, you know?
Wow. So, So do we know how many people did she kill?
Well, you know, in the end, she was only convicted for the murder of her son because they could prove beyond reasonable doubt that she had done it, because she had prepared a flask for him and they actually found traces of strychnine in his bones. Mm. And then they actually dug up, I mean, it sounds so macabre now to say it all these years later, but they dug up the two previous husbands' bodies, and there were traces of strychnine and or arsenic, but the bodies were so decomposed that they couldn't say beyond reasonable doubt that she had done it. She also lost a great many of her own children. I think it was 4 or 5, if I'm not mistaken.
Uh-huh.
Now, again, you know, in this day and age, a red flag would pop up immediately, you know.
Yeah.
But don't forget that 100 years ago, child mortality rates were completely different. Lots of people lost, you know, more than half of their children.
Yeah.
So weirdly, she was actually only convicted and then hanged for one murder. But if you really delve into it, like I did when I was writing my book, is there are at least 5 cases where, you know, it would be crazy to imagine that she didn't do it. So, yeah, she remains a very interesting case.
So staying with Daisy de Malcolm, and I know it might be a bit of a crazy question considering that this happened more than a century ago, but what was her motivation? Do we know what motivated her, why she did this?
She, in all the cases, except obviously her children, but in all the cases, she was the heir to whatever money her husband had. So she was the benefactor in their will. And in fact, when she finally got caught, was that her last husband, who she killed, his brother realized, he kind of traced all these events, something that the police weren't able to do. He traced all these events to see that she had been very manipulative in making sure that his will was changed quite shortly before he died, because he had other, you know, blood relatives like the brother himself. Again, I must just add that all these things I'm saying are, you know, I'm aware of the fact that I'm stereotyping. I know gender has become a very sensitive issue, as it should be, and we try to avoid stereotyping. But I think when we are talking about these particular women and the acts that they've committed and the research that's been done, you are going to have to allow me a little bit of stereotyping. But one of the very interesting things that researchers have often found about female killers is that it kind of almost goes back to evolutionary psychology, where men are hunters. So, you know, and again, I'm stereotyping, when men go out and hunt, it's often to do with power, it's to do with sexuality, it's impulsive, it's, you know, it's almost got a hunting kind of mentality behind it.
Confrontational, violent, yeah.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And, you know, bare-handed, visceral fighting. Women killers often, and I'm not talking about women who are, you know, like Ellen Pakis, who killed her tick-addicted son who was making the family's life a misery. I'm not talking about those kind of women. I'm talking about these cold-blooded murderers.
Yeah.
They often...
And as you said, it's a generalization. Obviously, yes. It's looking at the general, what you would find all too often, as opposed to those individual cases, I guess.
Exactly. That's right. So cold, you know, women who commit murder in cold blood, whereas the way I describe the men fits into the idea of a hunter. For the woman, it's a gatherer. So she's not out for, you know, she would be more out for resources, something material that she could gain. And again, it's not impulsive. It's much more planned and calculated. And it's a way of kind of gathering resources as opposed to going out there and hunting, which I find fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating indeed. I mean, just thinking of all these permutations and, you know, how she then ended up benefiting from this. It's just, you know, 100 years later, it's still extremely fascinating looking at that particular case. But now, I guess we fast forward and we start traveling through time. Who else stands out for you? I mean, I guess we can look at one more person before we take a quick break there, Tanya, if you don't mind. Draws immediate attention.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Well, I think one of the hardest chapters for me to write was the Joey Harhoff chapter. And just in case there are listeners who are too young or who don't remember, Joey Harhoff was, she worked with Gert van Rooyen.
Oh, yes.
There was a, do you remember in the late 80s, there was a kind of spate of young girls went missing in Durban, Pretoria and Johannesburg, and their bodies were never found. And Joey Harhoff and Gert van Rooyen committed suicide just as the police were closing in on them. And what I find so fascinating about that case is, right up until I started writing the book and really delving into these matters, I realized that she was always portrayed as a sidekick, and she was often spoken about in the media as the mistress. And, you know, she's almost stripped of any agency in the way she is portrayed in the murders, but yet she was the honey trap. And she was, for all we know, she was committing just as horrible acts as Gert van Rooyen was. And in fact, not so long ago, her daughter brought out a book about what a very, very cruel and abusive mother she was. And, you know, that case for me is so interesting, because that is a typical example of the media deciding this woman is a sidekick or a mistress. She has no agency over what she did. Maybe she's even under the spell of Gert van Rooyen. And then you flip the script and you go, no, women are just as capable of being a cold-blooded agent of murder. And I find that very interesting. And also, because I was the same age as the girls who went missing at the time that they went missing, so I remember we all lived in absolute terror of, you know, when it was happening, we didn't know it was Joey Harhoff and Gert van Rooyen.
You were white. Were a girl at that age. I mean, I was, you know, a colored little boy growing up in Risterfall, and my mum was dead terrified, you know. I think it was around about the time I started grade one. And there was this massive issue about, you know, kids being kidnapped. And you know, it was everywhere. And I guess, you know, for a parent, it doesn't matter. You're not going to profile and say, this is who they obviously targeting, and therefore my son, who is racially, gender and sex-wise, way out of their targets. You know, that didn't matter. They were dead worried about it. And it was actually a massive panic. And I remember very clearly seeing Gert van Rooyen's face all over the media. I can't even remember. For me, it felt like it was an age, you know. His face had been all over the media for months. But, and ironically enough, I guess even now sitting here, admittedly, I can't even recall how this whole thing ended. I just remember these girls and their faces constantly popping up on the late night news.
Exactly.
And then his face along with her. And then, you know, after that, boom, the story just disappeared.
Well, exactly. And he also, you know, he and Joey Harhoff, they also represented what in South Africa at the time was being portrayed to white people as the ultimate in, you know, your totally safe worm who lives next door, you know. Young white kids were brainwashed into not imagining that that's what the guy was going to look like who came to snatch you from outside your school gate, you know? So it was a real subversion of what the apartheid government was trying to brainwash people into believing, which was, you know, that is a dangerous person and that's not a dangerous person. And I mean, anyone who's on a neighborhood WhatsApp group in a middle class area will know that that racial profiling still exists.
Oh,
and then Joey and Gert flipped the whole thing, you know?
Yeah. Bravo males and all that in those WhatsApp groups.
Exactly. It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre.
But I mean, looking at the Gert van Rooyen story, and I mean, exactly what you were saying there, to this day, if you had to Google photos of him and I guess also going back to your point earlier on, I mean, Gert van Rooyen is the name that we all remember. We forget hers. You know, she was portrayed as the sidekick. But, you know, you Google their photos and they really look like the quintessential NGK woman, Tani, you know, that they
100%.
You know, he's balding with the glasses, you know, and smiling in those photos. And as you said, these are exactly the people you would trust when your child gets called over for an ice cream or a sweetie or whatever the case. But
exactly. And in fact, carry on.
No, you go ahead.
I just wanted to say that in the book, I actually, you know, because I kind of construct a scene where they go to have their photograph taken at a studio because all the photographs of them were studio photographs. And, you know, again, it's that thing of, you know, you look into their eyes and you look at their faces sitting there in the studio with their, you know, their moi beads hanging, Joey's got these moi beads hanging around her neck and her blue eyeshadow and everything. And you look into her eyes and you go, you know, there are still six families who have no idea what happened to their girls. And this is the woman who was part of it, you know. So just those photographs that are so emblazoned on your memory were taken in a studio. And again, you know, it's that thing of what you visually imagine. Oh. And then the kind of the cold reality of what happened. And in this case, we don't even know what happened to those girls, you know.
Ay, wow. But what was her motivation? What was the whole thing there? I mean, without necessarily giving away spoilers, and I guess it's a very heavy subject anyway. But what was going on there?
Well, I think, you know, in that story only, in my whole book, nobody ever really knew what they did to the girls or why they did it. There have, of course, been theories over the years that they were involved in a sex ring that was being kind of coordinated by some men in the South African apartheid government. You know, some people say they were just pedophiles who were satisfying their own needs, and then they, you know, murdered the girls and buried them somewhere. So I think the only thing crueler than allowing those girls to die, I mean, we can assume that they did. The second most cruel thing that they did was committing suicide before they actually told the police what they had done or why they did it. So that is still an unsolved mystery. And I'm sure you know, being in the media yourself, that every year or so, another story pops up, oh, bones have been found in Mhlanga, or, a body has been found under concrete of a pool in Pretoria near the House of Horror. But we'll never know, actually, what happened to those girls or what the motivation was. But one can only imagine that there definitely was paedophilia involved.
It's what one can refer to as the Jimmy Hoffa effect, you know, where there's constantly year in and year out, and there's a new lead, but it turns out to be a dud. Alternatively, exactly. No one can actually, you know, confirm nor deny exactly. that particular lead. And it's true what you're saying. It's the second most cruel thing they could have possibly have done was to kill themselves.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, those families will never know. And all these years later, as much as you and I can sit back and rationally say that obviously those girls have lost their lives, you know, I'm pretty sure that they are still members of those families, if not the entire family, who have hope, who may have doubts, and may think that there's still a chance, there's an opportunity that she's growing up somewhere else and might
Absolutely.
Just not remember. Yeah, that's
Absolutely.
Tragic.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of sort of quacks have preyed on the family. You know, we've had people who've come with weird devices saying that if they just have a strand of hair, they can, you know, they've got this little machine that will show them where the bodies are. And, you know, and some of the parents have actually since died without ever knowing what happened to their daughter. So it's incredibly sad.
No, absolutely shocking. Absolutely. Look, 26 minutes to go before we get to 10 o'clock. We'll delve into some more of your characters. Not characters, I mean people, actual people. That you cover in your book, without necessarily giving away too much, you know, spoilers, and look at some of the motivations behind this as well, because that for me is the one thing. It's. I mean, you know, I spoke to Jana Marx when Devilsdorp came out, or just before Devilsdorp came out, and the one question that always fascinates me behind these things is, what is the motivation? Why would you do this? And I guess it's because it's alien to us. You know, as relatively functioning normal people, you don't see yourself going out there and just killing people for fun, you know?
And
yet here we have people in this instance who've literally done that just for the sake of doing it. So yeah, we'll cover that conversation up next. 25 minutes to go before we get to
Walking This Talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
22 minutes left before we get to 10 o'clock. At the moment, I'm chatting to journalist at Times Live, as well as the Sunday Times and at the Times Media Group, as well as the author of Blood on Her Hands, South Africa's Most Notorious Female Killers. And we're speaking to none other than Tanya Faber, and I'm thoroughly enjoying a macabre conversation, but I mean, it's fascinating listening to you retelling these stories, Tanya, that are captured in your book, of course. And why we find this so fascinating, as I asked you right from the onset, why the specific focus on women, and it's so true what you're saying. And I guess that's why I'm so pulled into this conversation. And I guess if I could, I would probably ask you for a blow by blow account of, you know, of the book. But I mean, obviously we're not doing that. We will try. I'll really, by all means, try to avoid spoilers. And if I do get too close to a spoiler space, do tell me that, you know.
Okay.
Do tell me now. Okay, enough now, Gersh. Let's move into something else. But You know, the I guess motive is a key issue, as I highlighted in you know previously. You know, prior to taking the break, I mean, in terms of motive, and I guess I'm going to ask a very strange, out of the question. I mean, motive wise, what stood out for you amongst profiling these people? Because I guess in reading the, you know, writing the book and doing the research, one of the key things that you have to do is that you actually have to profile them to some extent.
Right.
And part of the profiling journey is obviously the motive for behind these murders. Because I guess, no matter how we look at it, none of these murders were just, you know, crimes of passion. And you know, none of them just so happened to pick up a hammer and smash someone. They were planned, right. They were thought through, but there must have been a reason for it. So do share that with us.
Well, I mean, before I talk about any specific of the murderers, I just want to say that, you know, when you think about motive and you think about men versus women, again, you know, we spoke about stereotypes and now we can talk about archetypes also. You know, when you think of, when one thinks of a male murderer, one generally thinks of, you know, the kind of impulsive killer that I mentioned earlier, or, you know, or a kind of a psychopath who very carefully plans and, you know, he's a narcissist and he's manipulative and he's got, you know, very cold eyes, but he can be quite charming. So they're only really, you know, in broad brushstrokes, only two archetypes for men. Mm-hmm. But when you come to women and you look at the archetypes and the kind of underlying motives that, I guess, you know, underpin the archetypes, you know, you've got your black widow, you've got your femme fatale, your sexy assassin, your creepy nurse, your baby-faced butcher, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, it's quite tempting to kind of look at each of these murderers and put them into one of those archetypes and go, okay, you know, your sexy assassin, you know, her motive might be political, you know, or you look at your femme fatale and go, her motive might be sexual prowess. Okay, so I'm just giving examples here. But then as I delved into each of the stories, they're all so different, you know, and I think that's what really stood out for me was we all find them fascinating because they are the anomalies that we spoke about earlier. But all of the cases are so different. So the female murderer is not this kind of homogenous person who goes out and kills someone, you know. Got... So for example, let me just think if I can talk about Dina Rodriguez, who organized a hit on a six-month-old baby.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people, especially if you lived in Cape Town, you remember that story of how she found out that her boyfriend's ex-girlfriend had a baby that he had fathered, and she organized a hit on this little baby. And, you know, so her motive there was to not have this baby complicating her life. But one, you know, while I was researching it, and even just, you know, when you just read newspaper articles about it, it's so hard to imagine that someone's mind would go to a place where not only do they think that they are going to kill this baby and their life is going to be much simpler without the baby, but they actually believe that they won't get caught and that they won't be punished. And so, you know, when you look at motive, you've also got to look at, you know, not just the sheer horror of the lack of morality of the act that was committed, but just the sense of this kind of this hyper focus on the goal, you know, to remove this baby who she saw as the obstacle to her happiness.
Yeah.
Without ever going, hold on, I could end up sitting in jail. I'm not going to be with Neil Wilson, my boyfriend, who's the father of the baby, after I've killed the baby, you know? So I find motive, I also, like you, I find it a fascinating piece in the puzzle because it really helps you understand the kind of psychology and in some cases psychopathy behind this careful planning that goes on. You know?
No, but certainly. And that, for me, is what stands out, you know, about that. And how then is it, as in this particular instance, and I guess it makes it so difficult, again, going back to the archetypes, as you'd mentioned, or not the archetypes, but what we expect, because it's a woman, right?
Yes.
And she must be nurturing. She must be motherly. She must have, you know, a maternal instinct. So in other words, no harm to a baby, you know?
Exactly.
You know, it's completely contrary to what we expect of her. And yet this child was enough of an object. And then that's ultimately what this child became for her, was enough of an object for her to then dispatch of in such a brutal way. And then that the child was ultimately the problem, you know, is the evil here. It's not her boyfriend that impregnated some other woman. It's the baby's fault for being born. And that was, well, that's what we need to get rid of here. So that for me is exactly. I think it's absolutely fascinating when you break it down and you think of it along those particular terms, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what I found also incredibly, you know, infuriating is an understatement, but what I found so difficult about researching the Dina Rodriguez story was that, you know, with some of the other stories, you can't ever justify what they did. And like I say, these are women who killed in cold blood. But say someone like Charmaine Phillips, who was the spree killer, you know, she did have an incredibly hideous childhood. But Dina Rodriguez was a lot lamaki, born into a middle-class family, older brothers who absolutely adored her. She had the world at her feet. And when she decided that baby Jordan was standing in the way of her happiness, she went and preyed on much poorer people in society. She literally went to a taxi rank and found four men to do the dirty deed for her. And I mean, the layers in a country like South Africa, like where do you even begin to unpack those layers of, you know, her literally going and shopping around at a taxi rank for murderers, you know, for accomplices. It really blows one's mind.
I mean, the sheer mechanics of it is just fascinating enough. I mean, why do you go, you know, hitman fire? You know what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, it's quite chilling, actually, when you think about, you know, as you say, like what her motive was. And then, you know, and in her story and several of the other stories in my book, you'll see that there were a lot of the murderers had a moment in which they could really easily have changed their minds.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Like, you know, Najwa Peterson also, she had stabbed Talib a few months before and he survived. So at that point, she could have gone, what was I thinking? I cannot believe I just nearly murdered my husband. But she didn't. Mm. She went straight back to the drawing board and started plotting her next method. You know?
I mean, a very, very tragic, high-profile case. Extremely tragic. And I sat down a while ago and finally watched sort of a documentary that recounted how it happened and what had happened and how she even then feigned, if I'm not mistaken, she started feigning illness and, you know, fainting spells and dizzy spells and goodness knows whatever else to try to, you know, just detract from her involvement in her role in this whole thing. It was just absolutely sad when I watched it. But let's talk about the spree killer that you cover, because I find that fascinating as a juxtaposition, for lack of a better term there, between your cold, calculated serial killer versus your spree killer, because that's because all too often when we talk about serial killers, we just talk about the notion or the idea that this is someone that you know has committed more than two or three murders, right?
And
therefore you're a serial killer, and we don't necessarily think about the spree killer, the person that just loses it and sort of goes on this wild murderous rampage. The immediate question is, why the hell do you do that type of thing?
So Charmaine Phillips is the spree killer I was talking about earlier, and she was a teenager, but she got involved with Peter Grundling, who was in his 30s. And the two of them, you know, they went on this kind of, I don't want to call it a road trip because that romanticizes it, but in the space of 16 days, they killed four people. And, you know, even then, they were kind of, the media portrayed them, they called them the Bonnie and Clyde of South Africa. And even that kind of romanticizes it in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's this kind of glamorous cinematic notion of, you know, this man and this woman. But when you actually dig into it, Charmaine Phillips had a truly awful childhood. You know, it was one of those things, both parents were substance abusers, there was physical abuse. She ended up in, I don't know how many different foster homes, but eventually she got involved with Peter Grundling, and they went on this killing spree, and in all the cases they took money or an ATM card, and then they would, you know, they would hold a gun to the person's head and get the PIN number. But again, just like with Joey Harhop, Charmaine Phillips in court, not the journalists or the judge or anybody else knew what to make of her, because on the one hand, she was wild. I mean, she spat in the face of a journalist in the courtroom. But some people actually saw her as being under Peter Grundling's spell, you know, that she was a teenager. He was in his 30s.
Yeah.
He was the mastermind behind it all. And, you know, actually, it's very hard to unpack, you know, to what extent can we always just assume that somebody has less agency over a horrific situation because they're female? Or was she just as evil as Peter Grundling and she knew exactly what she was doing? She had agency over it. And she thought, I don't care, I'm going to go on this killing spree and, you know, murder four people in 16 days.
I mean, it does make you think. I mean, I'm thinking about the Manson family, you know, and the Manson murders.
Yes.
Yes. You know, it was women, largely women. I think there was one male involved.
Yeah.
Charles Manson, ironically enough, didn't commit any of the murders himself. These people murdered on his instruction.
Yes.
And you know, how those women sort of shocked the media and society at large, because, I mean, they were constantly smiling and singing and, you know, seemed very happy with what they had done. And I guess the expectation, even though Charles Manson was manipulative, even though he had a strong cult of personality and influence over them, the expectation was that they were going to be completely under his spell and sort of crack when they get into court. And you know, sort of blame it all on Charlie Manson. But lo and behold, they stood there and they said, like, we did this. And I think to some extent, some of them were even let off comparatively, you know, when you look at sentencing, because the assumption was mm-hmm. that, well, they were young girls and they didn't know what they were doing. The man was behind it. And you know, he is the one that's, and that's why Charles Manson ended up dying in prison. So these are, you know, these are some of the weird, interesting bits that we see, you know, when looking at these particular cases. I'm sure you've noticed it as well. I mean, apart from, obviously, as you said, we spoke earlier on about, but she didn't see justice. You spoke about Joey Harhoff. You know, apart from that, but generally the portrayal is sort of, you know, something went wrong with her. And that this is out of character, basically.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, there's another chapter in my book about a young woman called Shane van Heerden, who, I mean, this story literally gave me nightmares while I was researching it. I'll just give you a kind of a brief overview. She got involved with a guy in a small dorpie in South Africa, and they... She put an advert to meet a guy for a date, and she said she wanted to meet him in the cemetery. And he was a really nice, sweet guy. He was a chemical engineering intern, and she met him at the cemetery. But her boyfriend was kind of waiting in the wings.
Yeah.
And they completely dismembered this guy. And these two were, you know, they had dismembered cats, and they chopped up his body. And, you know, when the police came, you know, the guy's eyes were in a jar. And I mean, it's the most bizarre story. But what really chilled me most about that story was not just the fact that she, you know, she skinned his face or dismembered him or buried his torso in the cemetery and his arms in her yard. What really freaked me out was that her boyfriend, Martin van der Merwe, was completely under her spell. You know, this, no one could even dream of portraying it as, you know, the man was the brains behind it or the brawn behind it, and she went along and she was under the spell of this guy. It's completely the other way around. I mean, this guy, you know, you can see he's a completely fragile, broken person. And he met this woman who had this, even in the world of murderers, even in the world of cold-blooded murder, it's very, very, very unusual to have a fetish for skinning people and dismembering them. But she kind of drew him in and normalized, you know, finding a local cat down the road and killing it and burying it in the garden, you know. And it's amazing to me that someone like that can exist, whether they're male or female. But then when they're female, there's this whole other layer of, you know, but you're supposed to be a nurturer. You're supposed to not want to do that to a cat, you know. So it's very scary. Well, it's actually scary.
But I guess that's always for me the fascination with human nature. I mean, it was a question that I asked recently when we were discussing serial killers in general. You know, usually when we talk about motive and murder, person wants to rob me. I gave them a hard time giving up my phone, my wallet, my car, whatever. And so they pull the trigger, I'm dead, I'm dispatched off, and they can get whatever they want, right? So usually it doesn't justify it, but it makes sense, for lack of a better term,
yeah.
Right? On the other hand, you know, it was a moment of passion. These two people are in a relationship, they had a fight, something was said, something was done that really, you know, took the person over the edge. Again, not justifying it, but again, understanding how these things happen. And someone loses it, and in a moment of blind rage, kills their partner. But I guess what always stood out for me is, especially when it comes to serial killers, whether it be women or men, for that matter, is what drives a human being to literally have a fetish for not just taking a life, but then taking a life again and again and again. And then on top of that, you know, so many of the other things that go along with this. It's not just taking a life. It's, as you said, sometimes the abuse, the dismemberment, you know, all of the stuff that you had mentioned. Yes. I mean, it's
accurate. Yeah. Well, I mean, what I find so interesting is that in South Africa, you know, we are one of the murder capitals of the world. I mean, let's just be honest about that.
Yeah.
But so few of murderers in South Africa are actually psychopaths, you know. We have created a milieu where there are people who, you know, for a whole host of reasons, the kind of the barrier to committing murder is fairly low for, you know, people who go and do it. But then when you know, they've done actual imaging using MRIs of, you know, more this kind of cold-blooded plan, you know, a killer who plans it. And there's actually, the circuitry in the brain is different. You know, there's the empathy, the circuit that kind of generates empathy is just not there. So I think for a lot of these killers, you know, they get their eye on the prize, whether it's, you know, the boyfriend or the money from the will or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And once they've got their eye on the prize, the living, breathing human being, often who they know, standing in front of them, is nothing but an obstacle, you know?
Yeah.
And I find it so fascinating. Like it's weird, but whenever I hear of a murder case, I ask myself, you know, is this circumstantial in the sense that, you know, circumstances under which this person is living has led them to do this?
Because
you also look and go, there are millions of South Africans living in abject poverty who are not murdering people and who are the most loving, warm people. And then you get people like Henry van Bredaar, who's got everything that opens and shuts, and he went and axed his family to death.
Exactly. And then blamed it on some Arab home invader that somehow just left him bruised, his sister with severe brain damage, and his entire family butchered, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And it comes down to so much more than, you know, it can be nature, it can be nurture, it can just be a weird glitch in the matrix and the circuitry in someone's brain.
So the key question that I have for you is, you know, after doing all of this, look, it's one of two things. Either this is absolutely fascinating and I'd love to come back to the subject matter, or I'm never touching this with a 10-foot pole again. So are you thinking of doing any, you know, any, not for a follow-up per se, but, you know, gifting us with any more works of this nature, or is this it for you?
Well, you know, I must say I wrote this book before the pandemic, and I think like a lot of people, the pandemic has made me feel like, you know, human life in general, globally, and in terms of the whole public is so fragile that I think what the world really needs now is, you know, stories about innovation and survival and, you know,
the uplifting stuff that we need.
Yes, exactly. The uplifting stuff, exactly.
Yeah.
Although, very weirdly, this book made me realize how many millions of normal, amazing people there are in the world. These remain the anomalies, you know?
Ironic, isn't it? But look, I'm out of time. I'll have to leave it there, Tanya. But people can get the book. I take it in all your major bookstores.
Absolutely.
And just remind us of the title again.
It's called Blood on Her Hands, South Africa's Most Notorious Female Killers.
And the author?
Tanya Park.
Cheers. Tanya, you've been
much.
An absolute star. Love the conversation.
Thanks.
And I'm
awesome
definitely getting testing. A copy of the book as soon as I can. All the best to you, okay?
Awesome. Thanks so much for the chat. Bye.
Cheers, bye. That was Tanya Farber. I think definitely well worth a read.